Hey, everybody. Welcome back once again to another episode of Retro Wrestling. I'm your host, Gene Jackson, and we've been on a little bit of a hiatus for just a bit while I've been working on some things, but we're coming back tonight in a big way, and we're going to get back in the groove of doing these, at least try to do them at least bi-weekly anyway. But tonight we've got a very special guest. This should be a fun episode. I've been looking forward to it. So right now, join me in welcoming our guest, the one, the only, Mr. JC Ice himself, Mr. Jamie Dundee. There he is.
Hello, brother. Hello, man.
How you been doing, Jamie?
Man, life is well, brother. Life is well. I can't complain about nothing, man. Donald Trump's president. Hell, life is good.
Well, that's good to hear, man. I know we've been through some hard times the last few years, so it's been a while since we've been able to say that, right?
Yeah, you're right. For real, man. And I guess it's one of those things, time stops for no man. But Donald Trump trying to get this this world back on track, bro, so we can everybody can afford to go out and do things and, you know, spread the money around amongst everybody.
Yeah, no doubt. It's been hard to do anything for quite a while now, but we won't get into all that. We're gonna try to have some fun here tonight, so we won't talk about all the
two things you don't talk about with people. That's politics and religion, because both of them will get you in an argument every time.
That's right. So tonight we're gonna talk about some fun stuff. We're gonna talk about Jerry Springer and wrestling. How about that?
The only two real things left on this planet are Jerry Springer and pro wrestling, baby. The rest of the world's a work, man. It's all a work.
That's right. Well, last time he was on my USWA show, and we talked a lot about 1993 USWA, and I told you I wanted to have you back because I want to talk about Jerry Springer. We've had some people send in some questions for you that we're going to get to. A lot of those are kind of wrestling related. So this time, we're not really beholden to a specific time period or promotion or anything. We can just kind of stay and go wherever it goes. But, of course, we're going to start with, now, folks, if you're familiar with the Jerry Springer show, if you've ever watched it, there was a whole multitude of interesting guests. And to figure out who would be, quote unquote, the worst guest on Jerry Springer would be pretty hard to do. But the man joining us on the screen right now holds the title of the worst guest in Jerry Springer history. They voted on that, right?
I think so. My daughter, my 15-year-old daughter, Jade Star, come running in the room. She said, "Daddy, you're blowing up on TikTok. You're blowing up on TikTok." And I said, "What the hell's that mean?" She said, "TikTok, you got like 2 million views on Jerry Springer. You're the worst guest ever." And I said, "I'll be damned." I said, "Let me tell you something, girl." So I did my homework. There was 5,000 episodes, 27 seasons, and 35,000 guests. And the world has voted me the worst guest ever. And that can never be taken away, because there's never going to be no more Jerry Springer shows. So I am the worst guest for the rest of eternity. In the year 3025, if someone types in who was the worst guest ever, you're going to see Dundee.
That's right. That is right, man. What a year you've had in the past year. You got in the Wrestling Hall of Fame, and now you've been voted worst guest ever. I don't know if you should be happy about that, if that should hurt your feelings or what. But it's certainly a distinction, right?
To me, it's the most exciting thing I've got going now. It's my new claim to fame, because first of all my shows were a work. Every one of my shows. Now, when I say that, I don't mean that the shows themselves were a work, just the person in them, which was me. So right. when someone would call the Jerry Springer show and say, "Hey, I'm pipping my wife's 14-year-old sister," or "I am as far like on my comic show," someone called in with these topics and they said, "We don't want to deal with that crazy son of a bitch, so we're gonna get Jamie Dundee to come up here and play this part." So the story itself is true. It's just not my story, but I must have played it so well that the world believed it was my story.
That's what's so fun, because for years people debated, was the Jerry Springer show real? Was it not? And things like that.
Well, this is the way that it went. They never told Jerry, "Hey, this show, these guys are working," or "this show, this is Dundee playing a part." You know, so every morning when Jerry would get up to do the show, he would read the topic of the show and he would write his final thought every time. you know, before he ever went to the air or anything, he read the topic of the show, and then he wrote his final, you know, at the end of the show where he said, take care of yourself and each other. Every one of those were a shoot, his opinion and his final thought on the show. That was, he wrote that before the show ever went to the air. Then when the show would go to air, then he would put that final thought in. So when people say, well, Jerry Springer's a work. No, it really, I don't guess it was a work, because the story is true. But they don't want to deal with some of them crazy people, man, because people are crazy in this world. People are plumb, just buck wild crazy, man. And so they didn't want to deal with that person. So they say, come on, get Dundee to come up here and play that part, which therefore, because they know I can make that part as a believable part, obviously, voted the worst guest ever. On that thing, there's 7 million views total, on TikTok and YouTube and everywhere. And there's like 60,000 comments. It takes like 10,000 comments before the first person smartens up and says, wait a minute, that's Jamie Dundee, the wrestler. This can't be real. But the first 10,000 people before that are saying, who is this guy? He should be in the penitentiary for life. He shouldn't be allowed on our streets. My children have to. Oh, it's great, because no one has a clue that I am this entertainer guy until somebody says 8,000 comments in. That's Jamie Dundee, the WWE wrestler, dude. That ain't real. So, but the story is real. They just didn't want to deal with that dude. So they said, Dundee, come play this part. So therefore, if you ask me, is Jerry Springer real? Yes, it's real. It's 100% real, because somebody called in with that story and they were really doing it. They just got me to play the part. So I don't know if you call that a work or not. I don't know how to justify that.
Well, and I think how we got there, I think it got to where it got to be an insurance hazard, where you got these real people up there attacking each other. And then you had that Jenny Jones show incident where the gay guy catfished somebody or whatever, and he ended up going and murdering the guy.
Yeah,
and I think all these talk shows are like, shit, maybe we need to figure out a way to have a bit of controlled chaos here.
The guy that stood at that wooden podium, you know, every time when Jerry said, let's go to break, and they would go to that guy, his name was Richard Dominique. He is the dude that invented, smartest guy on the planet, actually. He's the one that invented. Jerry Springer was the first show ever to have his name in the corner of the TV. So when you're flipping through the channels, it said Jerry Springer. That guy patented that, and he sold it to NBC, ABC, TBS, WGN, all. Because, you know, when we were growing up, you just flicked the channel. There was no little thing in the corner. He patented that, and he sold it to all the networks. But he was the genius that said, remember when Geraldo and them, the Klan was on there, and they threw it, and they broke his nose? He said, we need to do this like that, but every day. Yeah. And push the boundaries. You know, that it's a fine line right there on things you can say, things you can't say, things, how you can portray things. So it's a fine line right there. So as long as they had the security there who were real cops, Steve and Kurt Angle was a security guard for a little while on the Springer show when he first started it. So as long as they had tough dudes that could hook these people and just, you know, and everybody knows, you know, most of the time in a real fight, it ain't but a 30-second or 1-minute deal anyway, because somebody blows up. So if you can just get them to go and then hook them before they get to each other, then now it makes great television as far as the Springer show is concerned. And so that dude said, I know what, we're going to market this. We're going to make our show every day where people almost lock up or damn sure tie up. And then they did at the end start pushing really bad boundaries, because they just did a documentary on Netflix or something about the Jerry Springer show, and brought Toby Ushimura, who was the dude that was my producer guy, and brought them all in and kind of exposed it. But I mean, they were making so much money, bro. It was unbelievable the money them people were making, man. And I'm glad I got to be a part of it. It was a blast.
Oh, yeah. So let's kind of, you ran the gamut here. Like, so let's run down like the different characters you play. Like, you were pimping your stepdaughter one time, and then,
you know, I was pimping my wife's 14-year-old sister. So that would be my sister-in-law.
That's right. All right,
but me and the chick weren't really married, but I mean, it didn't matter. You know, on the Springer show, it is what it is, you know. Yeah. And me even took my dad on there. Well, you put my whole family on there, because I mean, they paid big money, man. I quit wrestling and everything. I didn't care, because I mean, they paid me $2,000-$3,000 a week, every week, to bring shows. And they loved me because I was the guy they could call on Sunday night and say, Jamie, we need a one-legged black transvestite midget to join the Klan. I'd say, I'll find him. I'd hang up and just start calling around, man. And I would find him. And we would fly up, and they would pay me a finder's fee, is what they called it. And then they would pay all, you know, all the people that come with me. And, you know, even though we're working in a sense, you know, it's awful hard to get people. People will say they'll do anything, but once you get them to that studio and they got to walk through that door, brother, it's a whole nother ball game, man. You don't know how many people during that tapings of them shows said, I ain't doing it, said, I can't do it, I'm not going through that door. And so they were smart about this. They flew you in on a one-way ticket. They flew you in. They put you up in the hotel. They bought your food. They take you shopping. They would let you go to the Bulls games. They would pay for everything. But the next day, if you didn't fulfill your part of the contract, they shake your hand and say, well, you take care, buddy, and get your own way home. Get home the best way you can, because you didn't fulfill your part. Then, by God, they're not going to send you back home.
Hey, that's smart. That's the way to get things done there.
Yeah, sure enough. Because people, you know, they think they'll go up there and they spend the night and they go to the concerts, or they go to the House of Blues and they go watch the Bulls play basketball, and their old lady gets their nails done and they take you shopping, and then the next day it's time to go live on the air the next morning, and they're like, nah, I can't do it. I'm not going out here airing my dirty. And they'll say, well, you take care of yourself. And then security will just escort them out there, send them to the bottom of the NBC studios, and send them out on the street of Chicago. Take care of yourself. And the people's like, what do you mean? They're like, what do you mean? You didn't fulfill your part of the contract. You take care. And then they're like, oh, okay, all right, then I'm going on there.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're out here, you've got these stories, wild stories getting sent in, and you're trying to cast these parts, more or less.
Right.
Who better than Jamie Dundee? Because you can go and pull all these independent wrestlers from all over the place. Fill that role, whatever the look needs to be.
That's right. That's why they love me so much, because they could call me on Sunday night if they were stuck and they needed two more stories or just two more people with a certain look. And they knew, they call me on Sunday night, Monday morning, we're on the airplane in Chicago, baby, in a two-hour flight out of Nashville. You know what I mean? And so I think that the Iron Sheik gave them my number for the very first time, because the Iron Sheik and a guy named Anthony Durrani, the pit bull, they did a story where the Sheik was supposed to be sleeping with his old lady while Anthony was gone on the road, right? And so they said, we need midgets. So the Iron Sheik says, Jamie Dundee has midgets. So that's how they got my phone number. And I'll never forget the first time the phone rang. I didn't know Jerry Springer was kind of a work. So when I say hello and the woman says, Mr. Dundee, this is so-and-so from the Jerry Springer Show, I'm like, hold on a second. Bitch, I will kill you, man. You know, I'm like, and my old lady's like, well, I didn't call Jerry. She's like, no, we need midgets. And I'm like, oh, okay then. Because, you know, I thought Jerry was more or less a shoe too. And I'm like, oh, you need midgets? I said, oh, yeah, I can get you some midgets. How many you want? The woman says, 100. I said, 100? I said, I don't even know if there's 100 midgets on the planet, is there? It ain't like you see a midget every day walking down the street or nothing. You know, you can go years. Some people ain't never seen a midget walking down the street, you know? And I was like, 100? I said, I don't know where to get 100. But I ended up with about 30. And so me and 30 midgets rolled through the Nashville airport and jumped on an airplane and flew to Chicago. And I never left, man. It was it. It was on from that moment on. They did a show called Invasion of the Little People. And they had midgets coming up through the floor, flying out of the ceiling, coming through the walls. And it was called. And I was like, well, I found 30. That was the best I could do. But yeah, they wanted 100 midgets. And I'm like, shit, good luck on that. I didn't even know there was 100 midgets. But
Jamie Dundee, midget wrangler.
Oh, yes, sir. And listen, I went through the airport with them midgets behind me, and I had every one of them, of course. Back then, I had my mohawk was tall, and I had it painted green. And I'm leading the midgets, and they're all going, oompa, loompa, doompa-dee-doo. And we just did it all the way through the airport, got on the airplane, flew to Chicago, did it all the way to the limo, and rode in. And not one person in that airport didn't stop and just stare at us as we went by.
Oh, you know they're still telling that story to this day about what they saw at the airport.
Sure enough, that whole airport, somewhere, wherever they are, saying, listen, I'm telling you, one time I saw a green mohawk dude with 30 midgets behind him walking through the airport. Yeah.
And people are going, yeah, okay. Yeah, green mohawk guy and 30
yeah, yeah, minutes. Right. Yeah. And see, you know, my dad was in the circus back then too, so then I could call my dad and get circus freaks, bearded ladies. We had everything, bro. There was nothing we couldn't get them.
I mean, that's such a hell of a gig because you got, you know, you got your trans paid, you got hotel,
everything,
and no bumps. Like you no do bumps. All the fun and parts of wrestling.
Fly in on Monday morning, leave at 6 o'clock in the morning, land, and a lot of times be back home Monday afternoon if you wanted to be. But a lot of times I'd make them fly me in either Sunday night or stay an extra day so I could go to the House of Blues because they pay for everything, anything you want except alcohol and tobacco because, you know, that's forbidden. But they, I mean, you would take this Jerry Springer funny money, it was called, and it was just big, big money that was printed off, and it had Jerry Springer's face in the middle, and in the corner was the denomination, 20, 50, 100, five, and you can spend it anywhere in Chicago because what they would do is turn it back in on Fridays to the NBC studio, and then they would get paid for it, you know, all the restaurants and all the places. And so they would give me stacks of that funny money, man, and go anywhere you want and tell tipping $50 on a piece of cheesecake. Because they want you to spend $18,000 an episode is what they have to write off. So you know that's including airline tickets, hotel rooms, the whole nine yards. So a lot of times they'd be like, "Here, Jamie, y'all want to go to the watch the Bulls play? Go watch the Blackhawks play hockey? Do you want to go to the House of Blues and eat and just give you stacks of that money, man? You know, I just give it to all the people that I brought in, and we just go all over town to give you the limo ride, treat you like a king. Now, if you called into the Jerry Springer Show, you got $50 and a night at the Days Inn. But with me, you got, because ours was kind of a gimmick. We was at the big fancy high-rise hotel, and we had the limo ride from the hotel. You know, we were treated great, man. They're like kings.
Yeah, because at that point, you're part of the show. You're not like just some random guest.
No.
Like your staff, more or less.
Right. And when I did so many of them shows, I said, every time you did the show, there's a guy in the back, and he's got a camera, and he's a lawyer for, it was called USA Industries Network or some shit, is actually the owner of the whole thing, right? And he would say, "I am a lawyer from USA," and he would hold that video camera and he would film you, and he would say, "Everything you're about to say is true on this. As you go out on this stage today, what you're going to say is true. If it is not true, we're going to sue you for the sum of $80,000, which is the production of this show today, you know, more or less covering their own ass, really." Yeah. And so one time, The Globe magazine called me. I got the article in my wall up here. You know the Globe magazine. It's kind of like, yeah, the Inquirer. And right, they said, "Mr. Dundee, we know you've been on WWF pay-per-views and WCW pay-per-views, and you know, yada yada." Said, "Is Jerry Springer real or fake?" And I said, "What? How much you paying?" And they're like, "Oh, well, we ain't paying." I said, "Click." So then they call back. They said, "Well, how much you want?" I said, "Depends on what the question is." And he said, "Is Jerry Springer real or fake?" And I told him, just like I said a while ago, yes, it's real because the people have called in with the story. The part I'm playing, no, it's not my part. I'm not really a pimping a 14-year-old. I'm not really a Klan member that inducted a black midget in the Klan. I'm not really, you know, I'm not a white supremacist. They flew me to England and we did a white supremacist show because they love my redneck voice. You know, they thought that was just the greatest voice in the world. And I said, but the stories are true because someone's called in. So yes, Jerry Springer is real, but sometimes the people in it ain't real. Well, that producer, that lawyer guy called me. He said, "Mr. Dundee, this is Johnny Dickface from USA Enterprises," and said, "We're going to sue you for the sum of $80,000. And I said, "Well, listen here, buddy." I said, "I can't get booked wrestling no more. They think I'm a Klan member. They think I'm pimping 14-year-old girls." I said, "I'm going to sue you for $1 million for defamation of character." He said, "Have a good day, Mr. Dundee." Click. He never had one that knew. Most normal people don't know none of that stuff. So, you know, they're not going to expose it because they're afraid they really are going to get sued for $80,000, you know?
Oh, yeah. Most normal people, they hear the word attorney and they draw.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. And most normal people, that is really, that's really, their show is real. You know, that they called in and they're really there because Johnny Jenkins is banging their old lady while they're plumbing, you know?
So is there any stories or characters that you remember approaching like one of your wrestling friends with where they were like, "No,
Jay, well, I tell you, there was a wrestler guy, which is pretty funny. His name is Mr. Ooh La La. And he was actually on a wrestling. He was on the first show I ever did, pimping the 14-year-old that my dad was on. Remember, my dad comes out and says, "I didn't raise you to pimp little girls," and yada yada. And he come up to me and my dad, and he's like, I know y'all don't know who I am, and I know y'all probably hear this all the time, but I am a wrestler, manager, whatever. My name is Mr. Ooh La La. And throughout time, I had remember seeing him on a few other cards and places and stuff. But he was actually on the first show that I was ever on, too. And I was like, I'll be damned, Mr. Ooh La La, because he had actually told Jerry he changed his name to Mr. Ooh La La, yada, yada. You know, because, you know, the first show, we just got like a little 15-minute segment. But then our segment had such big emails and shit about it that they brought me back for the whole exclusive hour. And so they flew in and two more little girls, and now I'm pimping four little 13-year-olds for Barbie dolls and One Direction CDs.
We'll return after these messages.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Give Me Back My Pro Wrestling, the podcast that's based on the old school but can still help you find the good stuff from today. Jimmy Street and the plastic chic Jared are the undisputed tag team champions of the wrestling podcast world. From thought-provoking topics to superstar interviews to action figure expertise, this team does it all. And all they ask is, give me back my pro wrestling! Every other Thursday, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Relive the glory days of Memphis wrestling with the Retro Wrestling Review USWA podcast. Each week, we go back in time to review USWA Championship Wrestling from the 1990s, episode by episode. Join us for watch-alongs, behind-the-scenes stories, and exclusive interviews with people who were there and lived it. Whether you grew up watching it or you're discovering it for the first time, this podcast is your ringside seat to Memphis wrestling history. It's all a part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network. Listen now at USWAPodcast.com.
Yeah, I remember seeing his name in the after mags back in the day, Mr.
Ooh. Right. Yeah, me too. After the fact, once he told me and stuff, I never would have known until he told me, but he's like, I know y'all, this ain't going to mean nothing to y'all, but so Mr. Ooh La La, there's your plug, pal.
There you go.
A wrestler and a Springer fan.
But I'm trying to think of, like, I know there was other people that popped up in there, and I'm like, oh, that guy's from IWA Mid-South, and like,
yes, lots and lots of guys. I took Frenchie Riviera, a big old guy. You know, he got hung in his brother's out his brother's trailer window, trying to get out the window. His brother catches him banging the old lady, and he's stuck in the window in his little wrestling tights. I took a bunch of guys up there actually, and then I know that Marvelous Mitch Ryder was on it. I know Too Tough Tony was on it. You know, I know there was a bunch of different guys that were on it throughout time, but most of the time I took. I took like buddies or friends of mine, just people that I knew, you know, just to, you know, because if you take all the wrestlers, it becomes, they didn't like that because the wrestlers become wrestlers, and they didn't want, like with my dad on that segment, they didn't like my dad because my dad would turn to the crowd and milk the people, you know, and they wanted it just to be, let it be real or whatever, I guess you want to call it.
Yeah, when it starts to getting obvious, they know how to work, more or less.
Yeah, right. Because my dad would say something to me and turn to the people, ain't that right? And the people pop, yay! And they were like, no, we didn't. You know, they wanted it just to be, you know, like they wanted to be personal between us and let the people just react the way they want to react, you know?
Yeah, that episode was fun because you could kind of shut your mind off and believe that you were this character, but like, being a wrestling fan, like Bill Dundee's fucking Bill Dundee. Like, you know, like it was so weird watching, hearing that unfold. Like,
and listen, bro, you should have seen my whole family when I started that. Every one of them's like, there ain't a fucking chance in hell you will ever get me to go on that show. And I said, well, they said they give you 3,000. Shit, hell, let's go.
What time are we doing?
Hell yeah, $3,000 to go. I said, yeah, for an hour. Shit, let's go. And matter of fact, my family, all my family members, my mom was on it because I did the pilot episode for Steve Wilkos to get his show. It's called Steve to the Rescue. And he's in my mama's backyard. They paid my mom. I mean, they spent $50,000 to make that pilot episode. They rented, they give my mom like $5,000 for her house. They give her $2,000 to be on the show. They give me, my dad had a limo company back then. So they flew to Nashville with Steve and the Richard Dominique guy. And then the producer, and every one of them had their own limos for 5 days straight, 24 hours a day. And that's huge money, you know, so they could go anywhere they wanted in Nashville and all that. And we stayed at the Vanderbilt Plaza Hotel downtown, that which is huge money to stay there, man. You know, Dwight Yoakam was in the damn lobby, and I mean that's that what a kind of a big deal that Vanderbilt Plaza Hotel is. And but you know, they want everybody to be right where they need them, so literally they spent bukus of money. And I just remember my mom saying, I can't believe I'm on this bloody show, but boy, the money's good. I said, hell yeah, the money's good, mama.
Hell yeah, that's awesome to be able to do that and then have your mom and dad both on there. That's
Yeah, you know, the good part, my mom has passed away now, but I can put that video in and I can hear my mom's voice. I get to see my mom. And it's awful funny because during that time is during my drug days, you know, and so a lot of it is kind of a shoot in the stories. You know what I mean? It's a lot of it is real. I mean, I was a wrestler. I didn't have 15 jobs. Like in the Steve story, we say I got in a fight. Hell, I went to the TNA office. I called Jeff and I said, Jeff, I got the Jerry Springer crew in town and we need a place to film like an office scene. So he says, okay, come on. So we go to the TNA office downtown Nashville there. They had done rented the big office thing. And I try to get Ron or Don Harris, the Blues Brothers, to be the boss. And they're like, nah, man. So a guy named Surge, who was like some big shot in TNA or something back then. It was Surge and whatever the woman's name was. But anyway, Surge plays the boss. They clear the posters off the walls and stuff. And so I come in there and Surge is like, Jamie, you know, I got to let you go. You got in a fight with Stuart. And Stuart is a guy that went to school with my partner, Wolfie. So I call Stuart. I'm like, Stu, baby, come on. I got you a spot on the Springer. You're going to say we got an argument in a fight and the boss is going to fire. So we're rolling up in that TNA office, man. We're using Big Surge, who's like this multimillionaire dude who's invested in TNA. He's playing the boss on the Jerry Springer show. I mean, it's great. Everybody's like, I can't believe they got that Surge. But I mean, Jeff said, damn it, Jamie, you can't use every. I said, we need three rooms, Jeff. And he's like, I got to take the posters down. But hell, I just love working with them because it was so much like wrestling, just no bumps.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and then another thing they loved about me and all our crew, we get it in one take. We're from Memphis TV, baby. We go live, we get it in one take. We don't need two, four takes. Let's get this in, roll it, let's go, keep it what we got. And it makes it more believable too.
Yeah, no doubt. And time is money in that business. So when you're able to knock that stuff out in one take, it's
it's great. Dixie Carter, that's the chick's name, the Dixie Carter chick. Okay, and then Surge was her, like, I don't know if it was her old man or her boyfriend or her other business partner or whatever. So, I mean, he was a big wig in TNA, and now he's playing the boss on the Jerry Springer show, and he's got to fire me. He's like, damn it, I can't believe you and Stuart got in a fight. I'm tired of it. You're fired. And I'm like, that's bullshit, you know. And then me and Stu shake hands, and, you know, because Steve's the big baby face. Steve's like, now shake his hand, Jamie. We're going to get your job back. You're going to do right. And I'm like, all right. So at the end of that Steve to the Rescue show, me and Steve's all buddy-buddy. We're going in house. I'm like, come on in, we'll get some coffee, buddy. And you know, and I said, my baby will be born soon, he'll call you Uncle Steve. And then it goes off the air, you know.
All's well that ends well there.
Oh yeah, yeah, because Steve's got to be the superhero, you know. He's got to be the big baby face because, you know, he's actually a shoot cop, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, nothing wrong with that. But and you know, back to your mom for a minute, you know, something cool about that for her is she got a payday without having to shave her head for once. So that's,
you ain't shitting, yeah, because my mother was such a like, it's really funny to even think about my mama walking the aisle and getting her head shaved. Really, it's just so good. My mother just totally was never no entertainment kind of, you know, that was a whole nother life, another world. You know, she definitely, you know, my mother would get embarrassed all the time over, you know, I guess my whole life I'd embarrass my mom on purpose. You know, I'd be in the stores or something. I would just get on the microphone, love you, mom, and shit like that. Just anything. My mama would just get plumb tore up. I mean, her hands would start sweating. She's just a little bitty old Australian woman. And so to have her on the Springer show, but because I told her, I said, Mama, you know, we want to film this. She's like, hell no, I will not get on that bloody show. It's rubbish, you know, and you know, rubbish is garbage, trash, yeah. You know, and yeah. She said, it's bloody rubbish. And I said, Mama, they're going to give you $5,000 to use your house. And then, well, come on, hell, can we, hell yeah, bring them on. I said, yeah, I imagine you would. For one night's work, they're going to give you $7,000 for the day or whatever. It was, my mom was like, shoot, we can film one a week if you want.
I mean, that's one of the greatest stories in wrestling history is, you know, of course, you know, your dad and Lawler, all those matches they had during that feud. But then that, it, you know, you get to that point in the feud and, you know, even fans that kind of thought they knew something like, well, they're not going to shave this lady's head. Yeah, that's right. Not going to happen. And then it does. And I mean, I can remember being a little kid and like my family at get togethers talking. Inevitably, wrestling would come up, and I'm like, my dad and my uncle's like, hey, remember that time they shaved Dundee's wife's head? Man, that was crazy. You know, people never forgot that.
Jerry Jarrett said to me when I started running my shows around here in Evansville and stuff, I run these legend shows in 2010, 11, and 12, and Jerry Jarrett came to a couple of them and filmed them just for this. We were going to do this reality show. But anyway, he said, Jamie, do you know how hard it is to convince a woman in 1979 to shave her head in the ring in front of 11,000 people? I said, I can't believe you did it. He said, let me tell you something. We started talking to her before the first week of that Lawler Dundee angle started. And it took all the way up to where they shaved Bill's head. And then the next week was going to be my mama's. And they still didn't have an answer. And Jerry Jarrett said, this is the only way I got her to do it. I said, Beverly, y'all been in America for 4 years because we got here in 1975, right? He said, Beverly, you've been here for 4 years. For $10,000, you can buy your house because a nice home was about $8,000 back then. Said you can pay your house off and have a couple grand in the bank, and y'all will be set for life after only being in this country for 4 years. He said, that was the only way I convinced your mama to shave her head. And I said, well, shit, man. And when I did that, I was just talking this story with somebody, and I did the math, like the equivalency of $10,000 in 1979. What is that money today? And it's like $114,000 today. Wow. Something to that effect. So, I mean, there's not a chick, there ain't a person on this planet for $100,000 that ain't going to shave their head in front of everybody on the planet. It don't matter. But, I mean, because, you know, with the economy and the way money is, I think it was about 112 or 14,000 is what 10,000 was in 79. Because, I mean, everybody in a year, they only made 8, 10, 12 grand a year, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you think that's one of the biggest payoffs in wrestling at that time. And it's, you know, to a lady to have her head shaved. But I mean, yeah, think of the money that them guys drew.
Oh yeah, it's unbelievable, man. Unreal. That was just, you know, in Memphis on Monday, because, you know, they sold them all out every, you know, they sold Monday night Memphis, Louisville, and Tuesday, but then they could only shave the head once. But, you know, they showed it back on the TV to all the other towns and stuff. And that angle was just so believable because the world didn't have the internet and it didn't know that Lawler had flew off to Japan. So when Bill beat Lawler and he disappeared the first time, Bill literally went to Memphis and stayed in the King's house. And, you know, the fans would see Bill checking the mail and driving around Memphis in Lawler Cadillac and shit. And they're like, man, Dundee really won that Cadillac, man. He's living in the house, you know, because people would go by Lawler's house and there'd be Dundee cutting the grass and shit like that. And they're like, oh, my God. And nobody saw the King because he was in Japan. But nobody else knew that. And then finally, when they bring him back, he's acting all drunk, you know, and Lance Russell finds him drunk in a ditch. And he's like, Dundee ruined my life. And I mean, it was just so believable that the world, because they made it believable, you know, Dundee's drove around in the car. Bill drove Lawler's Cadillac to Louisville and to Evansville and to Nashville for a couple weeks in a row when Lawler was gone, you know, and the world's like, where's Lawler? And they're like, holy shit, he's really in the car. You know, I guess it was believable because it was believable because, you know, they didn't know he was in Japan and they made it believable.
And man, it's so crazy because it's like, no matter what anybody does, that can never be replicated again. Like, nobody will ever be able to make people believe like that ever again, no matter what happens.
No, but when you watch that Memphis Heat that my dad says, man, we got that ball rolling. He said, them people believed. He said, hell, we believed. And the reason you couldn't make it like that again is because that none of that was script written, as they would say. Yeah. You know, nobody sat down and wrote down, okay, let's do the concession stand brawl in Tupelo with Wayne Ferris, Larry Latham, and Lawler and Dundee. It just happened to end up in the concession stand. They started throwing the mustard. Lawler told Wayne Ferris to duck. The mustard hit the wall. Then they knew they were going to have to pay for it. But the guy, you know, was just flipping out in the Tupelo arena. He's like, they broke the popcorn machine. But the reason that drew, because it wasn't planned. It just happened spur of the moment. And so that made it even more believable, because nobody knew it was going to happen. Not even them. It just happened. And the same as they knew they were going to beat Lawler. Dundee was going to beat Lawler for the money, the belt, the ring, the Cadillac, the house, and Lawler was going to go to Japan for 2 weeks or whatever the hell it was. And so then the world really thought Lawler was just drunk and gone somewhere. No, they didn't know where Lawler was, because, you know, back then you didn't know about all the other wrestling. And then they come back and Lawler wins the belt back, the ring back, the house back, the car back. And then the cockiness, you know, I don't need nothing from you, Dundee. I bet my hair. Loses the hair. And then he's really got nothing to bet the king no more. Well, I bet my wife's there. You know, as far as the moment, everybody's like you said, everybody said there ain't no damn way in hell they're going to shave Dundee's old lady's head in this ring tonight. And, buddy, when that 1-2-3 and they took her down to the ring, well, she was already at the ring, matter of fact, if you drew a big house with it the second time when they teased it. And they had all the wrestlers around the ring, you know, the Ultimate Warrior and Sting were the Blade Runners. And they had Pat Rose and Billy Travis and everybody all around the ring, Tojo and all that. And the people thought they were going to shave her head again. But the reason that Jerry Jarrett always said, you can't give them what they think's going to come. Because if you do, then they won't come back.
Yeah, he was a master at that. And there was a few times that, you know, he probably should have delivered on some things and didn't, and it kind of hurt the territory for a little while.
But also that goes to, it looks good on paper. A lot of things look good on paper, then you go, shit, that didn't work. Yeah. Back to the drawing board, you know?
Yep, absolutely. Well, we've had some people send in some questions. Let's ask you a few of them here.
All right.
Let's see. RollTideRick79@gmail.com sent in, is there any one thing about your wrestling career that you would go back and change if you could?
Yes, of course. There's always one thing anybody, in no matter what you do in life, would go back and change. I can't say that because I've always been like this. I've always been who I am. Since I was a little bitty boy, I've always been outspoken. I've always been funny. I've always been the class clown, whatever you want. But I believe I would have went back in the WWF days. I wouldn't have went there. See, the way I looked at it, they called me. I didn't call them. And I was already a star in my own mind, I guess. You're supposed to go to the WWF and you're supposed to be quiet and make your way through the ranks. And, you know, it's kind of hard to do when my daddy gave the Undertaker his first job and then Shawn Michaels his first spot and fired him, you know, and my dad hired and fired most of them dudes that were big stars. You know, my dad, yeah. We brought Stone Cold in against my dad, me as a manager turning on Bill, and brought Steve, you know. So to me, it was like, hell, I've been around long as these guys and longer than half of these guys. So to answer your question, I would probably played the politics a little bit more in the WWF than I did. But I always said, they called me, I didn't call them, and it was fun while I lasted, and it wasn't like they didn't know who they were calling. It wasn't like they went, huh, wonder Jamie Dundee, let's call this kid, I wonder what he's about. There's no way they didn't already know, so.
That makes sense. Chuck the Truck said in a question, he said, and I'm interested in this one too, because we talked about that this year. As T says, I want to hear about the tag team match when PG-13 wrestled Handsome Jimmy Valiant and Super Mario.
What a barn burner, baby. What a barn burner. Let me tell you something. The Handsome has always been my hero. When I was a little kid, as it was back to my mother again, they sent my mom in 1977 to go pick Handsome up at the airport. My mama was, like I said, a little shy, little Australian woman. In the end, she was feistier than hell and would tell you to go fuck yourself or whatever because she grew up and finally learned. But at that time, my mom was really kind of a shy. And so they sent Beverly to the airport to pick up Handsome Jimmy, baby. And he got on his blue and he's dancing, Beverly, and he's doing the boogie woogie and he kisses my mom in the airport and all just embarrassed the shit out of my mama. So my whole life, when Handsome came to town, I knew that I could get away with a few things at home. You know what I mean? Like when my mom and dad first got divorced, Handsome moved in. And it was Handsome, me, my dad, Dustin Rhodes, and Tessa Ray, and a couple of them, Super Mario, and a couple other wrestlers just laying around our big house there because Beverly was gone. And I wrestling with Handsome, to me, was like, it's kind of like, I mean, that's my hero, man. That's Handsome Jimmy, bro. You know what I mean? I couldn't wait to get the thumb up the ass and peed on by the dog in the arm wrestling spot. But as far as wrestling was concerned, yeah, we just shut up and did what we were told. And Super Mario give you the belly splash, baby, and Handsome give you the thumb and the bum, and we go into the house, baby. It all pays the same.
Yeah, man. Handsome Jimmy was such a character, man. So the story goes that Mario was a guy who, I guess, maybe came through Handsome Jimmy's school over there and drove Handsome, and Handsome would get him booked on shows. Is that?
Listen, Handsome is the only wrestler in the wrestling business that never had a car. Handsome never drove himself nowhere. Handsome always had a boogie-woogie somebody, a Super Mario. He had there's a guy in this town now named Willie Valiant who wrestled as Jammin' Jake Valiant. If you drove and had a good car and wanted to be a wrestler, Handsome would show you how. You could drive Handsome to every show. He would get you booked on the card, and he would show you how to get into the wrestling business and how to make a living selling gimmicks, because Handsome Jimmy would get on the CB and sell gimmicks up and down the interstate. He would sell gimmicks at every truck stop he stopped at. Handsome Jimmy could sell ice cubes to Eskimos, brother. I ain't shit. Man, that dude was the master of the gimmick sales, man.
That's amazing. And still is. I've seen him at conventions and things. He's still the master.
Well, you know, his place in Virginia, it's called Boogie Land. You go through it, you know, and at the end of it is when you open up the last door, there's Handsome standing there. There's a wrestling ring. His students are putting on a show. He'll sell you a popcorn, a Coke, a drink, whatever, a pitcher, send you going out the door, watch the show, whatever you want to do. And smart man, because it's all donations, tax-free, my friend. It's donations. Smart man.
I got to wrestle Handsome Jimmy like two or three times back in like 2000. At that point, he had a guy named Bruiser Graham, and that was his guy who was driving him around. He'd get him booked.
Yeah, he always had somebody drive him around. I don't ever recall Handsome ever driving nowhere.
Okay, so our mutual friend, Jimmy Street, you know Jimmy, right?
Yeah, love Jimmy Street.
He sent in a couple of questions. He told me to ask you about the Wendell Cooley threesome.
I was 13 years old. No, I was, 15. Let me see. It was 1987. So I was 16 years old. Wendell Cooley was a good-looking guy, brother. Had all the women up there in Continental Wrestling, son, let me tell you. And he was the first dude I ever saw bang two chicks at the same time. And, brother, these chicks were so freaking hot, man. And I can remember my dad wanted to go out with the RPMs. They were in Knoxville, and my dad and them wanted to go out, you know, and they couldn't drag me to no bar in Knoxville. You know, we weren't over like we was in Memphis or nothing like that where I could drag along, you know. Yeah. So he asked Wendell Cooley if I could hang out with him in his room, and I didn't know at the time, but Wendell says to my dad, look, I got these two chicks coming over. Now Bill said it'll be good for the boy. And so I'm in the other bed, and Wendell's in his bed, and then somebody knocks on the door, and these two chicks walk in, and they are so fucking gorgeous, man. I was like, holy shit. And Wendell bangs both of them, and I didn't mind. I thought, man, this dude is the shit right here, bro. I want to grow up and be like Wendell.
Oh, yeah. I grew up going to them Continental shows and seeing
definitely the first threesome I ever saw live, and I'm glad I did. And Wildcat Wendell Cooley, thank you, my friend. Thank you.
He's been a guest on this show. I didn't know to ask him about that at the time. So glad we could put Wendell on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, brother. He was over like Rover, let me tell you, son. That brother, he was the good-looking cowboy, son. Them women, man, shit, that brother got some women. I don't know if I should be saying that because he may have had a wife or something at that time, but him and them girls just sat around and read the Bible and played Scrabble, and I watched.
All right. So Jimmy Street's other question. He says, tell us about the police issue after your U-Shoot interview, the one where you got blasted and kissed on Sean Oliver.
It started out, flew me to Philadelphia to do Me and the Iron Sheik video for Feinstein, Rob, I think that his name, RF video.
Yeah.
So me and the Sheik do our 2 hours in the hotel room, and I don't know what they were thinking, but they brought us a fifth of tequila and 2 cases of beer and friggin' ounce of pot. Me and the Sheik drank and smoked, and now I got to go down to the Sean Oliver room, and I have to do another U-Shoot video, right?
Yeah,
I'm so drunk. I'm so drunk that I don't even really remember being there. But after that, once they give me my money and all that, and I have to go to the airport, I have to fly home. And so when I get to the airport, I tell the woman, listen, lady, wake me up when the plane gets here so I can get on the airplane. So I lay down in the airport like I always did, and I put my feet up in the seat, and I lay on my back, and I go to sleep. When I wake up, there's nobody in the waiting area, and the plane ain't there. So I start hammering this chick, you stupid, no good, yo, I can't believe you let the plane. But what I didn't know was the plane hadn't got there. I'd only been asleep about 10 minutes. Oh. But I thought this chick had done let me just sleep through the flight and miss it. Right. So I'm cussing her and hammering her. And so the police come. They put me in handcuffs, and they're taking me to jail. Over at the Starbucks is Brian Armstrong, the Road Dog, Brad Armstrong, and Steve Armstrong. They're coming back in from a WWF shot. And they just happened to be in the airport. So they come over and tell the cops, listen, we just got back from Germany. You know, they make this story up. We just got back from Germany. He's got jet lag. Said, if you just let him go, we'll take him over here, get him some coffee, sober him up. You know, the jet lag's got him, said, and we'll put him on the plane. And cops say, okay. And so they unhandcuff me. And when they do, I say to Jesse, Road Dog, I said, you know, me being Australian, we don't even have this kind of trouble in our world. I said, but you know, when the Civil War broke out, all they won when they won the war was they freed these greasy. And I call that black cop the word, brother, and they slam me on the ground and they throw me in handcuffs and they haul me off to the jail, and they're taking me to jail. And I said, what are you taking me to jail for? And they said, we're taking you to jail for public intoxication. I said, I ain't drunk. So anyway, the whole way to the jail, I'm hammering these cops. If it was the South, they would have pulled the car over, beat the shit out of me, and just throw me out on the side of the road, and them cops would have said, we don't know what happened to him. He fell when he ran away. And I mean, it was that bad, bro. And so when we get to the police department and I blow in the tube, it comes back 0.00. And them two guys look at each other, and I go, oh, you no good motherfuckers. I start hammering them again. You better get me back to the airport on my fucking airplane, you no count, no greasy man. And brother, the whole way back to the airport, I hammer these two fucking cops, man. They didn't have no stripes on. I'm saying, you ain't got no stripes, you fucking jackoffs, because you don't even know how to be cops, you no count. I mean, I hammered them all the way back to the airport. They have to go in the airport, buy me a hotel, put me in a hotel, and put me on the next flight home to Nashville because they don't have nothing to charge me with. Right. Except, you know, their initial charge was, we know he's drunk, we know, and I was fucking drunk, but I guess the sleeping and the time to the airport and back and all that shit, I was sober as hell, man. And the look on them cops' face was fucking priceless, bro. Because that one looked at the other one, he said, Whoa, what are we going to do now? I said, what you going to do is get me in that car, you motherfuckers. And I just start hammering all the way back. I hammer him. I swear, if it would have been the South, that poor Dundee would have got shot, or he would have got the shit beat out of him. I mean, they wouldn't have put up with it. And them old Northern cops, the whole way there, man, they're just looking at each other like, holy fuck, man. I can't believe we got this wrong. And so that was my fun evening leaving Philadelphia. And they put me in the airport. They put me in. They said, please, Mr. Dundee, we're so sorry. I said, I know you're sorry. You're fucking cops. And they said, we're going to pay for this room, but please, we're going to just please stay in the room and sleep. We'll come and get you, man, and we'll put you on the next flight. And I'm like, okay, I want McDonald's. I started ordering fucking food. And I mean, I made them. They were like, oh, my God, what have we got? What have we got ourselves into? So once again, it ended pretty good for Dundee, but it could have been a bad, bad day, man.
Ooh, yeah, you got lucky on that one for sure.
But have you ever seen that video with me and that Oliver dude? Yeah. You saw how drunk and brother, yes. When they got me to that jail and I blew in that tube, it came back 0.00. The look on their face, I bet mine was too. I bet I thought, how the fuck did that happen? Because I was so drunk.
You could have grabbed another one just to make sure.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. I was so drunk. I've never even sat down and watched that video.
It's something else, man. Because, not right around that time, you had did a podcast with me and I had people messaging me going, man, Jamie was like just sober as a preacher. And he knew his stuff. And I was like, well, yeah, because we talked at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday. They went and filled Jamie full of liquor for 2 hours and then threw a camera in his face.
John Oliver dude brought another fifth of fucking tequila with him. Because he came down to that room that Feinstein's in, that room with me and the Sheik and Eric Sims, right, Eric? Mm-hmm. And we start, because they were going to call that video When the Taliban Meets a Redneck. It had an Iranian flag in the Sheik's picture and a rebel flag in my picture. And it was going to be called When the Taliban Meets a Redneck. Well, by the end of it, they said, fuck it. They called it up in smoke, covered it in pot leaves, and said, these two should be in a jail cell together, not fucking free in public. And then I went from there. I walked down the hall like five rooms to the Sean Oliver's room, and he's got another fifth of Patron, because he came down to that room when we started that video and said, Jamie, what do you want to drink on our video? I said, Patron, man, shit, the best of the best. And so I believe after he did me, and then the Sandman's was about as bad as mine, they said. Yeah. And I think those were like the first three. That dude said, fuck this, I'm out of the wrestling business. Dude said, I am not doing this no more with these dudes, man.
Hey guys, Ray Russell here, curator of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network. Inviting you guys to listen to many of the programs here as part of the WrestleCopia brand, including, but not limited to, the Wrestling Memory Grenade, currently covering the 1988 and the WWF project. You can also listen to the Regional Wrestling Podcast, where we talk the territories. You can also listen to the Wrestling Stoop with the legend himself, Bob Roop. But that's not all. You can also check out the Puro Wrestling Academy with the professor of Puro Resu, Mr. Dan Ginnity. Dan and I go back in time and cover the history of Japanese professional wrestling in the English language. And you can listen to all of those shows and more, all part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, located over at WrestleCopia.com. That's WrestleCopia.com, and anywhere your podcast streaming needs are met. So if you're looking to support that next up-and-coming podcast brand, please consider making it WrestleCopia.
Tired of the same boring wrestling podcast? Need something with attitude, chaos, and maybe just a little cussing? That's STSPod.club, and we got it all covered. We've got wrestling weirdness with WTF News Desk, 5-minute time limit, and a Southern Fried Brain of me, BT, stirring the whole ship. We also have Rolling Into Memphis every week about the current Memphis wrestling. interviews, hot takes, and wrestling outrageousness so wild it might get you banned in 12 states. That's right, it's SDSpod.club, or search all podcast catchers for Shooting the Shiznit, where wrestling podcasts grow chest hair. Not sure what that meant. Love my mama.
Couple more questions here, and we'll let you go.
Sure.
Paul Anthony asks, he's been watching our USWA podcast, apparently. He wants to know, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the name Jeff Gaylord?
$1 million body, 10-cent brain.
That's
fair. That's what we always, that dude was a sin against his own talent. That dude was just a massive, you know what I mean? For people that don't know, he was a Missouri State football player, a great Missouri State football player. He played for Missouri College or whatever, Missouri State College. He got drafted to the NFL, and before he signed the NFL contract, he got caught banging like the coach's daughter or sister or something before he ever signed the pro contract, so they never give him the pro contract. Wow. I mean, you know, something to that effect. I don't really, because it's been so long, but he was in the, I don't know, because he has $1 million body and a 10-cent brain. I'll tell you a great story about Gaylord. Gaylord was a big, strong, tough son of a bitch, man, for real. You know, I mean, he was a cock strong powerhouse. You know, he robbed a bank. You know, he ended up robbing a bank. Yeah. And then they let him out, and he robbed the bank again, and they put him back in. And then, yeah, and then he finally got out, and then he just passed away not too long ago, which was crazy because he sent me a message on Facebook when he first got out of prison, and he's like, dude, because his favorite thing to say was dude. And so one time we're in Evansville, Indiana, where I live now, and he's like, dude, because, you know, I lived in Memphis then, so we would always hook up, ride, you know, from Memphis to me and Brian Christopher or, you know, somebody from the Memphis area. But at this time, it's me and Gaylord. And so Gaylord's like, dude, you want to do some blow? I said, Gaylord, man, because, you know, we got paid on Wednesday night. I said, Gaylord, man, I ain't, you know, I got to go pay this, that. And I said, I got about $60. He's like, we don't need no money, bro. I'm like, well, sure. So Gaylord has these two guys, these two dudes meet us. Like at the Evansville Coliseum, there used to be like a building right next to our building. And we, in this alleyway is where we parked to go in the back door and back out. So Gaylord had these two dudes like drive somewhere anyway. And we pull in this alley, and our car's this way, their car's that way. We get out, Gaylord gets out. I'm driving. I get out. We walk, the two guys get out. The dude hands Gaylord an ounce of cocaine. Gaylord goes, pulls his billfold out, says, police. And them dudes take off running. Gaylord said, told you, dude. We got back in the car, backed out, and snorted cocaine all the way home to Memphis. Never seen them dudes, never heard another peep from them people. I don't even know. I just looked at him. I said, well, that was fucking great, man. He goes, told you, dude, told you. So we got in the car, just did bumps and snorted coke all the way home, man. I was like, son of a bitch. Because he's like, dude, we're going to get an ounce. I'm like, I don't have no money for an ounce. The ounce of cocaine back then is $1,000 or something. He's like, don't worry about it, dude. We don't need money. And after what he did, them dudes handed him that, and he just pulled his billfold out, said, police. And they fucking took off. We got in the car and snorted coke all the way home to Memphis. And they didn't come back to the wrestling show the next week. You know, I was kind of worried about that. I was like, the next week, we're going to have a little bit of trouble. He's like, fuck them, dude. And never heard, I don't know if them dudes are watching, thank you. That's all I
can say. Oh. You know, I meant to ask you about these guys when you were on last time, and talking about Gaylord made me think of them. Tell me about the Marino brothers that you guys, that was one of the first tag teams that you and Wolfie worked with when you came to USWA.
Yeah, well, see, that Billy and Steve Marino, I had knew both of them from the Outlaw Circuit. Like Dale Mann, they were Dale Mann's top boys at one time. Like they were a little bit older than us, so a few years before, you know, before me and Wolfie ever tagged, where they were kind of a hot tag team in Dale Mann's organizations, you know, his little outlaw towns and shit. They were called them, you know, the Marinos. And so when we was working with them, kind of like, cause we had like a little routine. We did Thursday in the outlaw days before USWA, we wrestled Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So we had a 4-day week every week. We wrestled Thursday night in Shelbyville for the Mullins boys. Friday night in Central City for a guy named Shelby Adcock. Saturday nights in Beaver Dam for Shelby Adcock. Sunday nights in Bowling Green for Dale Mann. So, you know, that's why where we got a lot of, you know, to get a tag team over, you got to feed them teams. So, you know, we went with Billy and Steve. We went with, you know, Cool Breeze and Tommy Higgy as Mephisto and Dante. We went, you know, just that's how you get a tag team over. You just feed them different teams for 2 weeks at a time and then send them on. And Billy and Steve were kind of like veterans of the outlaw world, for real, you know. And so we brought them in there to work with us. And matter of fact, funny story. Billy Marino's son came to my wrestling camper about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago when I lived in Henderson, Kentucky. He comes to my camper and one of my other buddies said, "You know this guy's dad?" I'm like, "Well, who's this guy's dad?" He said, "Billy Marino." I said, "Well, hell yeah, I know Billy Marino." I said, "Hell, I used to watch Billy Marino when I was a kid." So I give him a couple programs, you know, USWA programs that had his dad in there and things like that. And if I'm not mistaken, Steve has passed away, but Billy was still alive. But I mean, they weren't really brothers, but I mean, they look good together. And so I gave this kid some programs, you know, stuff like it, just like John Cronus's son just put a thing out. You know, John Cronus was one of the eliminators. His son just put his son's probably 18, 19 now, and he just put a thing out. Joe King is a guy that used to does another podcast show and used to write for some of the magazines or something. And he forwarded it to me where John Cronus' son says, if anybody has any videos of my dad, because when Cronus passed away, he was only 4 or 5 years old. I sent him some programs and I got some videos I've run off. I'm going to send him, you know, and stuff like that. Cause I mean, you know, I grew up with my dad, but I can't imagine losing my dad when I'm really young and then just wanting to see and know about him. You know what I mean? Cause you know, at the young age like that, he don't remember at all, you know? Right. And so I told him, I said, "Listen, go on YouTube. There's a lot of good matches between me and your dad on there." I said, "Your dad was a hell of a worker, bro, and was a hell of a guy too. John Cronus was a hell of a dude, man. He really was." Now, Perry Saturn was really rough on him because John was kind of the dumb one and Cronus was the engineer. But I mean, you know, things like that. That guy's son came there. So I definitely gave him programs, and you know, just like, because I can't imagine, you know, it wanting to know about my dad if somebody had things. So if anybody's listening to this, you're watching this, and you got some John Cronus stuff, find that boy and send it to him, man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's cool. He was able to hook him up with some stuff. So we'll end on this question. I figure this is going to spawn at least one or two interesting stories. Phil Rogers asked, on the latest episode of Doug Gilbert and Tommy Rich's podcast, they talked about working the ICP Juggalo Gathering shows. Do you have any wild stories from working those shows?
Let me tell you something, bro. They were smart because they didn't tell me about it till 10 years after it was running, because that Juggalo life was like they tried to put the clowns with me and Wolfie in WWF. And Wolfie's like, "I know, you know, I..." When they made the oddities and stuff with Luna and all that, they wanted me and Wolfie to work with them. Wolfie's like, "Yeah," but then that cat arrived. But anyway, the Gathering of the Juggalos was one of the most, it was one of my favorite times ever. It's funny. Dutch Mantel was the referee. It was me and Too Tough Tony in a drunken death match. And a drunken death match is where you wrestle for 1 minute. You do shots of Jack Daniels for 1 minute. You wrestle for 1 minute. You do shot, and the first one to throw up loses. So we had Dutch Mantel as the special referee. And of course, we're going to gimmick the Jack Daniels, right? It's going to be tea, but nobody else knows that, right? But Dutch Mantel would say to me, "Jamie, where does 20,000 people dressed like clowns go at 2 o'clock in the morning?" It was so quiet and peaceful. It was one of the only places that I've been to biker rallies. I've been to Bonnaroo. I've been to concerts like that, which is all weekend. Never have I been to a place where everybody loves everybody. It's kind of like, my wife would, is totally, you know, opposite. My wife grew up in a Christian Pentecostal world. You know, when she listens to some of these stories, she's like, "Jamie, that's not normal for a 16-year-old kid to watch some dude bang two chicks." I'm like, "Well, it was in my world. If it's normal shit, right? I mean, that's hell, that's great." But to her, it's just something you can't fathom, you know? what in kind of fucking world did you live in, you know? And I said, well, listen, if everybody's doing it, it can't be wrong. But at the gathering of the Juggalos, man, there's 20,000 fucking people all with their face painted like clowns. And no, they're all getting along. They all love each other. If you're hungry, they'll feed you. If they're thirsty, they'll let you drink it. And they do every drug known to man. That's a fact. It was something I'd never seen. And I have been all over the world, and I did a lot of drugs in my day. And they got a fucking thing called Drug Bridge, where people are just standing on the bridge with signs around their neck. And it says, I have heroin, I have cocaine, crack, and it's got prices. And I'm thinking, are you fucking serious? How long have they been doing this? Nobody ever told me about this in my drug days. And they were like, well, Dundee, we weren't going to be responsible for you OD. And man, I'm like, I get you. I understand. But it was really one of, I took my wife to one of them gatherings. And we stayed all weekend, you know, and we did the whole deal. We did the camping deal, and we, because they used to do it up here in Cave and Rock, Illinois, which is only about 35 minutes from my house here. The first year I went, I didn't take my lady. And then when she saw the pictures, all the chicks are naked, their tits are out, you know, they're off, they painted up. And my wife's like, you're not going back there by yourself again next year. So she went, I said, well, then you got to go. And she went with me, and she said, you know, Jamie, it's crazy she said, I went there wanting to hate these people, and I left loving them all. You know, it was one of those kind of things that I don't know how to explain it. It was, if you've never been to a gathering of the Juggalos, you need to go, because it's one of those things, you judge a book by the cover when you first see it and read you thinking, I would never. And once you get there, man, it's a pretty good thing. I loved it. I loved working for the clowns. It was one of my favorite times. Thanks to Tracy Smothers, brother.
Tracy Smothers. What a great guy. You know, yeah. That's kind of what you were saying there. Doug and Tommy both said that something that really stood out to them is that them guys that, you know, the ICP, Violent J, and Shaggy Two Dope said they were two of the most respectful guys of the business. They paid everybody that worked for them exactly
what always.
They couldn't ask for anybody better to work for.
No, sir. And another thing too, it was kind of like they didn't forget where they came from. You know, they started out two kids and painting their faces out of Detroit, driving a little black van that they painted their face on the side and wrote ICP and just drove all over the world trying to get booked, you know, as far as a rap duo. And then they learned to wrestle, and then they started their own federation, you know, and you know, honestly, Sabu and guys like that, when ECW closed and all that, they took them in, brother, and they took care of them, you know, as long as they could take care of them, man, you know. And let me tell you something, some of them fucking, I got some of them programs here, I guarantee you their payout with the rappers and the rock stars and the wrestlers, their payout had to be fucking $1 million. They had Charlie Sheen, Bobby Brown. They had Cheech and Chong. All the mega stars of every kind of genre you can think of on these fucking 3-day weekends, man. Not counting, you know, Razor Ramon, Kevin Nash, every big star from every kind of fucking genre, comedy world, anything you could think of, they had the top of the line for a 4-day weekend, man. And the fucking payout, I was sitting and looking at the program and think, holy fuck, I couldn't imagine having to pay all these motherfuckers more or less for the weekend, man, you know. And but never, not one time did they ever, that I know of, fuck anybody out of any money, you know. They know what it is to try to become, you know, to depend on someone to pay you. And I got nothing, my hat's off to them, man. I got nothing but respect for them. I hear that one of them's in a little trouble right now for doing some dumb shit, but that's everybody, I guess, in life. Everybody makes a stupid decision, you know, and I just wish him well, man, because I got nothing but love and respect for both of them, man, for real. And they did it right. They started from nowhere, and they earned it, man, and they never sold out. They never, you know, Disney tried to give them $1 million to change their songs, and they're like, fuck you. We're not changing our songs. Fuck you and your contract. And then they got a write-up in Penthouse Magazine after they turned Disney down, and they took off even more, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing, man. They had some of the biggest stars in the world out in the middle of bumfuck nowhere out there.
Charlie Sheen and Bobby Brown and fucking every rapper you can think of. You know, Jelly Roll, Lil White. I mean, anybody you can think of, man. And Master P and fucking, and then they have the wrestling crew, and you know, and they never. There's four stages going. Well, this stage got something, then that one got something, and I mean, it's a hell of a weekend, man, and it's. It entertainment at its finest, I will say, man. And you would never think that in the middle of the fucking woods with a bunch of people dressed up like clowns, man. Would you think that by God, that, who would think Bobby Brown and fucking Whitney Houston all ever running around the field fucking naked with their tits out? You know?
I bet they visited a drug bridge, though.
Hey, that drug bridge was the damnedest thing. That was the damnedest thing I'd ever seen. And I have been all over this world and did drugs. And I was like, why didn't nobody tell me about this fucking place, man?
I bet Bobby and Whitney hit that place twice at least while they were there.
I believe they bought the whole fucking bridge. They probably just bought, there was nobody left. They just bought everything on the bridge and shut it down, man.
Speaking of that show with Doug and Tommy. So we've had some pretty good thumbnails for these shows. I was proud of this one here. Of you on the different stages of Jamie Dundee on the Jerry Springer show there.
Man, that is fucking great. I saw this one on the left not too long ago. Somebody sent that to me. But the other two, I ain't never seen. Wolfie drew another little one of me one time. It says, hey, I'm Jamie Dundee. Fuck you. It's another little cartoon version he drew of me. Wolfie did. And it was me on a talk show set. But it was the Jamie Dundee set having my picture. I'll send it to you. Let you check it out. It's a little video.
That needs to be on a t-shirt or something. So then
t-shirts and I'll wear them and we'll sell them, by God.
Yeah. For the Doug and Tommy episode, this was the thumbnail for that one. Then we painted
up. That is great.
I don't know if they've seen it yet. I was expecting a phone call once they saw it.
That is fucking great right there, man. I love it. And, you know, I got to send a little shout out to my friend Rooster, man. His daddy was Paul Neighbors, who was Jerry Jarrett's cousin, who passed away last week. And I ain't talked to Doug in a while, but Doug sent me a little message, and it said, hat, jacket. Because one time I said to Paul Neighbors, hey, man, where the fuck's Randy Savage's hat and jacket? And he goes, hat, jacket? I go, yeah, Randy's fucking hat and jacket. He wants his hat and jacket. He said, what hat and jacket? I said, fuck, I don't know. I just, and so it was kind of like a running joke, didn't we? Would all out of nowhere, we would just say, hat, jacket, what fucking hat and jacket? So I guess when Paul Neighbors passed away last week, just out of nowhere on my phone, I pick it up and it says Doug Gilbert and it says, hat, jacket. And I was like, hell yeah, he done passed away, old hat and jacket shit.
That's his heart. Yeah, poor Paul had been in poor health for a little while, so I hate to hear he passed, but he's in a better place. And it's great, you know, guys like, you know, you and Doug and everybody that's, you know, you guys have these little things like that. You can send somebody a two-word text. You know exactly what the hell he's talking about.
Yeah, we know exactly what. And there was another one about Tojo Yamamoto, and we're all on the bus going to Dallas, Texas and back, right? And Tojo, for some reason, I think he thought we called Eddie Gilbert Homer. So he says to Doug, Homer Fly? Doug said, what? He said, Homer Fly? Doug looking at me like, fuck's he talking about in Japanese? He said, Homer Fly. He was asking Doug because Jenny wasn't on the bus. Did Homer Fly? And so that was another inside little running joke for years. Just Homer Fly. And then we would just fucking. So when you see Doug or talk to Doug next, just say hat, jacket, Homer Fly. Just saw his little fucking word. He'll know exactly what you're talking about, man. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly who I've been talking to. Wow, how in the world did he think Homer?
Yeah, he said, Homer Fly? Told Joe and Doug, they said, what the fuck is he talking? I said, fuck if I know some Japanese shit or something, I don't know. He's like, Homer Fly? So that became a running joke for still today. It's a running joke. Motherfuckers say Homer Fly, we know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, Jamie, this has been a lot of fun, man. Thank you for coming on the show, as always. And, We'll have to maybe do this again, get some sure. Questions together and have you drop in.
I got some good Doug and Tommy stories too, by God. We'll get some of them Doug and Tommy stories.
We're going to get you on there soon too.
Yeah,
that'll be a lot of fun.
Poor Doug had to babysit me one time on fucking GHB. If nobody knows what that is, it was called Scoop. And they fucking scooped me, and I just kept falling over from Dallas, Texas, all the way to Memphis. I was falling over, and finally Doug just said, fuck it, let me lay my head in his lap, let me sleep all the way there. Fuck it. I guess he patted my hair or something. I don't know.
Well, thanks again, man. We'll talk to you soon. And Jamie, always a good time talking to you, brother.
My pleasure, brother. Thank you very much. And Jerry Springer's worst guest for the rest of eternity, baby.
That's it. They can never take it away.
Can't take it away. See you, pal. Thank you.
See you, buddy.
Listen up, you bunch of slack-jawed flea market freeloaders. If you think you know Memphis wrestling, you don't know nothing till you've heard the Retro Wrestling Review podcast, brother. Every week they're talking the real stuff. Lawler, Jarrett, PG-13, yeah, and even my Moondogs. Watch long stories from the road, interviews with folks who are in the thick of it, brother. The blood, the beer, and the bail money. It's all on the Wrestlecopia Podcast Network. Go to uswapodcast.com or I'll come down there and I'll slap a taste out of your mouth.
Shining big and bright, and you might run into a moondog and meet your man.